I'm going to call Michael McCarroll up here to go ahead and officially start our session and introduce us to our topic. So Michael, please take it away.
Yeah, thank you, Jean, and hello, everyone. I'm Mike McCarroll. And one of the first goals I had when I started in the Superfund program was to take a look at the soils groundwater transfer model in our soil screening guidance and see what could be updated. This model is meant to be used in the early stages of site evaluation when not much site-specific information is known about the subsurface. And because of this, it relies on a lot of conservative simplifying assumptions and default values. So we got a group together to talk about what areas of the guidance could be looked into for possible updates. And we came up with a big list of things, but the two things we decided to focus on first were the DAF, the default attenuation factor, and the infinite source assumption. And Alex and Seth will get more into these in a bit. And that doesn't mean that we don't plan on looking into other areas of the guidance as well. It's just that this is where we decided to start. So we got this intern project together to look at what information is out there and to lay the groundwork to kick off this effort to update the guidance. And I just want to note too that these new values that we're going to talk about today, they're not being added to the guidance right now. It's more of an investigation to see what information is out there that we may be able to include in a future update if we think that's the best route to go. So our first presenter will be Alex Valdez. He's a recent graduate from the University of Maryland Global Campus, where he graduated with a Master's of Science in Environmental Management. He also received a bachelor's degree in chemistry from Virginia Tech and has worked for the Department of Health and Human Services, the Federal Bureau of Investigations, and the U.S. Army. And after him, you'll hear from Seth Whitaker, who is an undergraduate student pursuing a Bachelor's of Science in Ecological Management and Restoration at the University of California, Davis. In addition to his internship with EPA, Seth studies carbon biogeochemistry and soil information systems with the California Soil Research Lab. And after graduation, he hopes to continue working to protect human health and the environment through a position with state or local government or federal government. And with that, I'll pass it off to Alex to get us started.
Thank you, Michael. So before we get into some of the specifics of our project, I thought it was first important to define the problem, you know, why our project has importance, along with going over some of the big picture history relating to the EPA's 1996 soil screening guidance, along with some basic geology. I realize many people on this call, especially after the poll, have way more experience and education in this field than myself, but I figured it can't hurt to review some of the background science and history for those of us like myself who don't work with these concepts every day. I think this will be especially useful if you did not have a chance to read our paper. And with that, I'll go ahead and start working through my slides. All right, so first, defining the problem of groundwater contamination in the United States. About half of all households in the U.S. depend on groundwater for their domestic usage for things like bathing and drinking. Protecting these groundwater sources is, of course, going to be critical because exposure to contaminated groundwater can result in really detrimental acute, chronic, or carcinogenic effects. One of the main ways groundwater becomes contaminated is from contaminated soil that is above the water table, which will eventually leach into the groundwater. And I'll be providing a bit more of an overview into how these contaminants transport from soil to groundwater in two slides, I believe. Some examples of sites with contaminated soil include municipal solid waste landfills, illegal waste disposal sites, and leaking storage tanks, among other things. Of note, there are naturally occurring sources of soil contamination. However, for the human link sources, many are designated by the EPA on the National Priorities List, or NPL, under the Comprehensive Environmental Response, Compensation, and Liability Act of 1980, CERCLA, better known as Superfund. So of course, once a site's soil is suspected of being contaminated, it's going to be critical to identify what chemicals present an unacceptable risk to human or environmental health. Effective risk characterization can help identify the most harmful chemicals while screening out those with levels that may not be as big of an issue. For the most harmful chemicals identified, one can further assess what remediation, if any, is needed at a site to bring the soil to an acceptable state. And to reiterate, effective risk characterization helps narrow the focus of a remediation effort. So next, I'm going to go cover a few things related to the US EPA's 1996 soil screening guidance, or SSG for short. Basically, an oversimplified overview of the soil screening guidance is basically that this guidance was developed and is currently still used as a framework to determine what contaminant concentrations in soil require remedial action or further investigation. This guidance helps speed up the evaluation and cleanup of contaminated soils by providing generic and site-specific guidance on screening chemicals of potential concern. As I stated on the previous slide, screening chemicals of potential concern is critical to identifying to effectively cleaning up site. And so with the soil screening guidance, it is possible to calculate risk-based soil screening levels, or SSLs, that correspond to the pollutant concentration that present an unacceptable risk to human or environmental health via different exposure pathways. Of note, I will briefly be going through some of these equations in a few slides. With that being said, for contaminated soil, exposure pathways include direct ingestion, inhalation via particulate volatilization, and finally, contaminant leaching into water sources, which then actually creates a new exposure pathway, as you can see on the figure to the right of the slide. Of course, soil erosion can also contaminate water sources as well. However, the rest of this presentation will be focused on that leaching of soil to groundwater. Okay, so continuing to get through some of the basic principles that will set up the main part of our work. Soil to groundwater contamination occurs when a contaminant moves through the vadose zone, aka the unsaturated part of soil, into the saturated zone, or basically where the top of the water table is. After a contaminant gets into soil, various physical properties of contaminant, like vapor pressure and soil adsorption, along with the hydrogeologic characteristics of a soil, like porosity, moisture levels, and organic content, are going to affect the transportation of that contaminant down through the soil. Eventually, a contaminant will reach the water table, assuming that groundwater is present, which is going to potentially pose an unacceptable hazard to environmental and human health. Since most groundwater flows are really slow, contamination can linger for long periods of time. So the figure on the right presents just a pretty basic visual of how a contaminant can move through soil into groundwater. Again, pretty self-explanatory, but certainly important to understand before we go ahead and move forward. All right, so now we're going to get into some of the equations used for calculating soil screening levels, or SSLs, that deal with contaminant migration from soil to groundwater. To reiterate, the two equations you see on the slide are used for calculating a sufficiently protective soil screening level for a particular contaminant that will not lead to excessive groundwater contamination. These two equations are very similar, the only difference being one is used when the contaminant in question is inorganic, while the other is used when the contaminant in question is organic. On the right of the slide, you can see what each of these variables are defined as. For those not familiar, I'm going to go ahead and provide a very brief explanation of each. So KD, KOC, and H prime, which are the soil water partition coefficient, the soil organic carbon water partition coefficient, and the Henry's constant, respectively, are chemical specific constants that define how a chemical is going to dissolve in water or evaporate. Theta W and theta A define how much water and air, respectively, take up in the space between soil, as even the most compact soil is going to have some space between the soil particles. Rho B defines just how dense the dry soil is, and these variables may be determined for a specific site, but for the soil screening guidance, the US EPA used default values as defined in the soil screening guidance's user's guide. CW, or the target soil leachate concentration, is a chemical specific value or contaminant concentration goal that's based on a 1 × 10⁻⁶, so that's 1 in 1,000,000, individual excess cancer risk for carcinogenic contaminants and a hazard quotient of 1 for non-carcinogenic risks, excuse me. Essentially, it is quote unquote, the risk defined acceptable concentration of a chemical that is dissolved in water. And we will go into a further explanation of CW in equation 3 on the next slide. All right, so in this equation, the MCLG, MLC, and HBL are all chemical-specific concentrations based on the human dose response to said chemical that define the maximum acceptable concentration of a chemical in water. Finally, the last factor of DAF in this equation is the dilution attenuation factor, which is going to be the focus one way or the other of the rest of our presentation. Of note, I will use dilution attenuation factor and DAF interchangeably. And just to be clear, the DAF is a dimensionless value. Okay, so as promised, we'll now be getting into the main part of our presentation. Since this is a fairly niche subject, go over some of the background or history of the DAF development, along with the current use of the dilution attenuation factor. So Gene, I guess this is where we pull up that first poll. So before moving on, out of curiosity, we have a poll for everyone in the audience, and I guess I'll hand this over to Gene.
All right, thank you. I'm about to launch that poll, and you should see a new pop-up window now asking a simple question. How familiar are you with the dilution attenuation factor? Very, somewhat, or not familiar at all? Of course, as before, simply click the circle to the left and then hit the submit button. It looks like about 2/3 of you have voted. I'll close it here in just a moment, but for anybody who's having technical difficulties, you can always put your response in the Q&A. If you don't even know what that is, you can also put that in the Q&A as well, provide context for our speakers. All right, I'll go ahead and close the poll. I think most of you have voted. Those answers are slowing down. I'll close it here in 3, 2, 1. And it looks like about half the audience is somewhat familiar, and then the remainders are saddling in on either side, either very familiar or not familiar at all, Alex.
Awesome. Thank you, Gene. Very interesting to see. Appreciate that. So actually, we'll go ahead and continue. And so with this, we're going to basically define the DAF as if you've never heard of it before. So I'll go ahead and start off by reading the EPA's 1996 verbatim definition of the dilution attenuation factor, mostly for those calling in and can't see the slide. I'll go ahead and read it verbatim. States, quote, as soil leachate moves through soil and groundwater, contaminant concentrations are attenuated by adsorption and degradation. In the aquifer, dilution by clean groundwater further reduces concentrations before contaminants reach receptor points, i.e. drinking water wells. This reduction in concentration can be expressed by a dilution attenuation factor, defined as the ratio of soil leachate concentration to receptor point concentration. The lowest possible DAF is 1, corresponding to the situation where there's no dilution or attenuation of a contaminant, i.e. when the concentration of in the receptor well is equal to the soil leachate concentration. On the other hand, high DAF values correspond to a large reduction in contaminant concentration from the contaminated soil to the receptor well, okay, end quote. So a bit of a simplified definition. Basically, for every 1 part of a contaminant concentration in soil media, the corresponding concentration of that contaminant in groundwater is expected to be whatever that concentration is as a leachate multiplied by 1 over the DAF, or 1 divided by the DAF. Basically, if you have a concentration of a pollutant in soil, it's called X concentration, and there is groundwater present, you expect the pollutant's concentration in groundwater to be less than the concentration of that pollutant in soil, or less than X, due to a variety of hydrogeologic factors that result in dilution, which we'll get into in the next slide. Finally, a reoccurring point of focus in this presentation will be the EPA's defined nationwide default DAF of 20. And that'll come up again. Oh, okay. On this slide, we will break down the different variables that go into calculating a dilution attenuation factor. You can see the equation for a DAF represented by equation 4, along with the variables on the right of the slide, which I'll now briefly touch upon for, again, those of us without a hydrogeologic background. Hydraulic conductivity, or K, is defined as the ability of a fluid to move through spaces in between rocks, like pores and fractures within a rock. The hydraulic gradient, or lowercase I, simply refers to the slope of the water table. The aquifer mixing zone depth, or lowercase d, is defined as the depth to which the contaminant is diluted in groundwater. Infiltration rate, or capital I, is defined as the rate of recharge of precipitation to the groundwater. Basically, it's how fast water moves through the soil vertically. Next, the length of area concerned parallel to groundwater flow, or capital L, that refers to the length of the contaminant source in soil that's adjacent and parallel to the groundwater flow. So in the context of soil to groundwater migration, this is going to be the length of contaminated soil directly leaching into the aquifer. And finally, the aquifer thickness, or lowercase dA, is exactly what it sounds like. Basically, a measurement from the top of the aquifer to the bottom that is then used to calculate the aquifer mixing zone depth, or lowercase d. Okay, so just to quickly review the equation we covered so far and relate how the dilution attenuation factor relates to soil screening levels. So on this slide, you have the equation for a soil screening level on top, which we covered in equations 1 and 2. When you break down the equation of the acceptable concentration of a pollutant in water, or again, CW, as we saw in equation 3, again, middle, we're talking about the middle equation on the slide, we introduced the dilution attenuation factor, or DAF. And finally, so, the bottom equation, we have the breakdown of the variables that make up a DAF calculation. One important thing to reiterate for the DAF is that the value can never be below one, as the lowest possible value for KID over IL, this factor right here, can only be essentially zero and cannot be negative. However, theoretically, the value of the DAF can be very high. And in our research, we did see DAFs that were calculated to be well over 100,000, for example. However, as I stated, the EPA's soil screening guidance uses a default DAF of 20. And now I'll get into how this default was developed. Okay, so some brief history on this nationwide default DAF of 20. The EPA relied on two studies to determine a nationwide DAF standard. In one study, the EPA used a Monte Carlo simulation that consisted of 15,000 iterations, various nationwide input parameters to get a statistical distribution. Data for this came from the US EPA's composite model for leachate migration with transformation products. The second modeling effort utilized data from two large hydrogeologic surveys. The American Petroleum Institute, or API, conducted one survey and compiled the usable data into a database known as the Hydrogeologic Database, or HGDB, while the other survey contained the EPA's own data that was collected from nationwide dense non-aqueous phase liquid contaminated Superfund sites. All right, since data from the hydrogeologic database was readily available, Seth was able to use and transform this data in more ways than just a simple nationwide DAF, which I'll cover in three or four slides. To set that up, I'll be going over a bit more history relating to the development of the original 1996 hydrogeologic database. Data from the HGDB can be found in Appendix F for the EPA's 1996 soil screening guidance, in case you're interested in looking at that data yourself. Just a heads up, unfortunately, it isn't a PDF format, but we can provide an Excel version of that if that helps you out or if needed. So anyways, data for this database was collected via a large nationwide survey of about 8,700 members from the Association of Groundwater Scientists and Engineers. After the surveys were filled out and returned, API identified around 400 or so usable responses. Reasons for surveys not being usable vary, but some examples include not enough data was provided, missing administrative data was not provided, or just plain unresponsiveness. You can see some of the quantitative and qualitative data points that were collected from these surveys, with the quantitative data points neatly lining up with the inputs needed to calculate a DAF. So just remember, we just covered it, but per equation four, the dilution attenuation factor is going to be equal to 1 plus k times little I times little d over capital I times capital L. As you can see, matches with the quantitative factors there. On the right of the slide, you can see the approximate locations of where usable responses were collected from. Granted, these are approximate locations to keep the survey respondent data anonymous, but you can see this is fairly representative of a nationwide survey, with just Arkansas and North Dakota being the only two states not having any suitable responses for whatever reason. Again, as this survey was deemed representative of the hydrogeologic conditions across the nation, the database was deemed usable for calculating a nationwide DAF. So hence there was a nationwide DAF. Okay, so just to reiterate, the inputs or variables used to calculate a DAF mostly have to do with hydrogeologic conditions. So while this default value has been used across the United States, the default DAF does not account for the large hydrogeologic variations across the country or even within relatively small regions. Pretty intuitive, but for example, a glaciated mountain valley is typically gonna have vastly different hydrogeologic characteristics than a coastal beach. Regarding current use by many state level environmental agencies and their equivalents, most stipulate using a DAF of 1 or 20 when calculating soil screening levels. One exception, New Jersey actually went through and determined New Jersey specific values for each of the DAF inputs, like hydraulic conductivity, hydraulic gradients, et cetera. Coincidentally, even after doing all that, New Jersey came up with a New Jersey specific DAF of 20. And just to be clear, the New Jersey specific values of the various inputs were different from the soil screening guidance default values, but the NDAF was still 20. And while we have already touched on this extensively, the DAF is currently used during the risk assessment process when calculating generic soil screening levels, which is generally during the early stages of a site investigation. Okay, so now that we finally made it through all that background, we will get into some of what we did in our internship that wasn't just historical research. To be frank, simply researching how this nearly 30-year-old guidance was developed was a major lift in and of itself, but that work was certainly necessary to be able to propose updates. So after we researched how the default DAF was developed in the late 80s and early 90s, we began looking into what more specific, but still quote-unquote regionally generic dilution attenuation factors would look like. A paper from Heath in 1984, published in 1984, identified 15 unique hydrogeologic regions in the United States with numerous subregions. The hydrogeologic database itself broke down the data into 13 of these regions, with the discrepancy between 13 and 15 coming from Puerto Rico being left out just due to lack of data. And alluvial valleys was defined as a subregion within the HGDB. Of note, two of these 13 regions in the hydrogeologic database are simply Alaska and Hawaii. So it's pretty simple what those are. And so now that we knew what these 13 regions were, we could then calculate hydrogeologic region-specific DAFs that are typically going to be a better representation of the contaminant movement and dilution in groundwater than one single nationwide dilution attenuation factor. So you may be wondering how you would know what hydrogeologic region you're in at a given location. So this map answers that question with 11 of the 13 regions outlined. Again, Hawaii and Alaska are their own regions, and they're obviously not pictured here. Seth was able to create this map from GIS data from Clogs and Price. The 11 regions are color-coded, which you can see on the key at the bottom of the table. In case you were wondering, the small black outlines within each state are county-level outlines. You can see that the hydrogeologic regions often go through both state and county lines, which obviously makes sense since nature isn't going to simply follow our neat political boundaries. I'm not sure where people are calling in from, but with a product like this, it shouldn't be too hard to figure out what hydrogeologic region you're currently located in. Of course, if you're right on the edge between two or more hydrogeologic boundaries, it may be more difficult to identify what hydrogeologic region you're in, but we're going to go ahead and put this map to the test. So that being said, Jean, we have that other poll for people to answer.
All right. All right, so I'm about to launch this poll, and it's going to ask you what hydrogeologic region are you in? Unfortunately, Zoom doesn't allow me to add 13 or more pick list options, so I had to combine. So if you are in regions 1 or 2, you'll see that as the first choice, or regions 3 or 4. You can pick multiple options here. And the critical thing is, let's say I think I'm in both region 1 and 4, then you would check the first one, 1 or 2, and the second one, 3 or 4. I apologize for having to group them in that way, but I do just have a limitation what this tool let me do. Once you're done submitting your answer, I'll just remind everybody, if you're not sure, all the way at the bottom of options, the last choice you can pick from is I cannot tell. So you can always click that one and then again, submit your response. And this is really just double checking on the application of this tool. It looks like about 2/3 of you have submitted. If you happen to have navigated over to email or were distracted, now's a great time to click back to the webinar and make sure you share your thoughts here on this poll. Okay, I think I've got about 3/4 of you. I'll go ahead and close the poll down in 3, 2, 1. And we do have a number of questions that have come in, and I just remind the audience, we see all of those questions. They are fantastic. I appreciate that input. And we will be pausing for questions later on, so keep those questions coming in. All right, Alex, I've shared the results here, and it looks like most of the audience was able to share a response. Only 4% said they couldn't tell, and it did look like about 30% were either in 1 or 2, and then the other 30 roughly percent were either 7 or 8 or 9 or 10.
Great. No, that's very interesting. So it does suggest that this analog map is pretty useful. So thank you for participating. That definitely is helpful for us. We will, for those of you that couldn't tell, we will cover that in just a few slides, or possibly towards the end. I forget exactly what. Okay, so we'll go ahead and move on. I think I have to click now because I was clicking other stuff. Okay. All right, so on this slide, we have the results of the hydrogeologic region, the hydrogeologic region-specific dilution attenuation factors. Again, we got these results from calculations using data from the hydrogeologic database. Of note, this box and whisker plot has a logarithmic y-axis, so that's important to keep in mind. The two numbers you see at the top of each region's box and whisker are the number of data points, or n, and the median value for each of the hydrogeologic region-specific DAF. The general trend is that the median region-specific DAFs do vary pretty significantly from region to region. Additionally, within regions, there are pretty high deviations from the determined median values. Unfortunately, as you can probably tell, the number of responses are not uniform across the regions. Generally speaking, the more populated regions had higher numbers of responses, you know, which does make some sense. And regarding the lack of data points, we will dive a bit deeper into that in the limitation section and our recommended future work sections, but you can at least get an idea of what these region-specific or hydrologic region-specific DAFs would look like. All right, so I'll go ahead and briefly summarize the limitations of our research, which I hinted at, and then in a few slides, how to address some of the limitations in future work. So again, I already hinted at it, but some of our region-specific dilution attenuation factors don't really have a large pool of data points to make any significant conclusion from. Really, all the regions could probably use more data points, as the highest number of responses in a region was, I think, 65. Anyways, when it comes to concerns, one concern is that in the survey, there was no standardized methodology or instrumentation required when reporting things like hydraulic conductivity, infiltration rate, and so on at a respondent's survey site. Relatedly, there was a wide range of experience for the survey responders, with almost half claiming they had less than 5 years of experience as a professional geologist, a hydrologist, or something related to that. This lack of experience could have made data collection errors more likely or significant. Additionally, as highlighted in the Newell et al. Article from 1990, there are concerns with the data accuracy for some of the variables that make up the dilution attenuation factor. Specifically, over half the survey respondents estimated the accuracy for their measured hydraulic conductivity values to be plus or minus 50% of the reported value, which of course is quite a lot. Another limitation that I hinted at a bit earlier was the need for some sort of GIS tool when determining what hydrogeologic region a site of concern may be in. Of course, determining what region you are in is going to be critical in identifying what region-specific DAF you should use when calculating a generic soil screening levels. Based off the results of our poll, seems like most people could, you know, use a simple analog map for the location, but this map integrated into an GIS tool can be integrated to a GIS tool pretty easily to get a definitive answer of what hydrogeologic region applies to them. So for like the 4% of you, you should be able to use a GIS tool that would not be hard to develop. Finally, the 1996 soil screening guidance and calculations of the dilution attenuation factor assumes the contaminated soil is unsaturated with contaminant. Basically, if the contaminant is in a free phase at a site, then additional calculations are going to have to be made. Of note, this was not the focus of this project, so we didn't really research much about this, but it can certainly be expanded on in a separate project in the future. And now I believe I'm going to go ahead and transition this over to Seth.
Yeah, so Alex just did an excellent job introducing our efforts to improve the spatial resolution of the DAF, as well as the background of the DAF. I'm going to switch topics up a little bit and talk about a different proposal that we had that would improve the temporal resolution of the DAF. And in order to explain what I mean by that, I'm going to use these four plots on this slide here. So you can see they're arranged from left to right in order of accuracy. And all of them have the same y-axis, which is showing the concentration of leachate over the initial concentration of leachate. And so this graph on the far right here is what we'd imagine to be something like actual dispersion in an aquifer. Of course, this is hard to calculate because fluid dynamics are hard to calculate, but this is a good model for our purposes here. Currently, the soil screening guidance has this assumption that steady state concentrations are maintained over the exposure period, which we'll also call the infinite source assumption. And that looks like this plot on the left here, plot A, where the contaminant concentration never decreases. Obviously, this might be a good model for sites that have a really long history of contamination or a really, really high contaminant load, But for most sites or most chemicals at a site, this isn't necessarily the case. As we move towards a more realistic assumption, we might come up with a plot like B, where we'll say, okay, we'll assume that we still have an infinite source until a point where we assume that the chemical is depleted, at which the concentration just completely drops off. This is a little bit better, but in some ways it's even less accurate because unfortunately contaminants don't just disappear. So that leads us to plot C, which is drawn from this paper by Rizzi et al. In 2000 and shows complete mixing and linear equilibrium partitioning. As you can see, if we're trying to describe actual dispersion with a straight line, C is probably the best approximation. And all of this goes into calculating what we're going to call a finite source correction factor. So something that we can multiply the DAF by to move from this infinite source assumption to a finite source. And we're going to talk about that in detail over the next few slides. So to begin with, we're just going to talk briefly about the equation presented by Rizzi et al. In 2000, which we're not going to go into all of the math behind, but there are a couple things to point out. So first, the Peclet number essentially measures whether advection or dispersion dominates in a fluid. There are multiple possible values, but for this proposal, and then for this calculator that we're going to present in a few slides, we chose a default value of 10 based on Rizzi et al.'s suggestion that it applies to the highest number of contaminants and the highest number of situations. The other really important value in this equation is the source decay constant. As you can see, all of the other values are either time or this dummy variable that disappears during integration. So then the source decay constant captures all of the other chemical and site-specific data. When we expand that, you can see it does capture a lot of data, including a lot that Alex has already brought up as the components of the DAF, as well as some that are unique and new here, such as the retardation factor, which is actually calculated using another EPA calculator. To explore how these values actually impact this finite source correction factor, we're going to pull up the calculator, which is available at growingecology.com/finite-source if you want to follow along on your own computer. We've also shared the link, I believe, on the page that you used to register, and I believe it was just shared in chat. So we'll move over to the calculator, and it's very simple to use. The only necessary action is to pick a chemical, which will draw on these chemical-specific values from an EPA database. All of the rest of these are set to be a default value, either using an EPA default, or if you type your own thing in, it will use that number instead. So we'll pick vinyl chloride, for instance. And then another important thing to point out is that all of these are an EPA default value, except for the fraction of waste in the landfill. There is no default value for this because it varies so widely from site to site. We'll stick with the 5% fraction right now and click calculate. And we get a finite source correction factor out of 3.96, which is actually fairly high. And as you'll see, if we do it for some of these other values, it ends up being either in a similar range or much lower. Another important thing to note is that I did include PFAS and PFOAS in here as provisional values, but since it's such an up-and-coming area of research, use these values carefully because EPA does not necessarily have solid default values. Then to indicate how changing some of these values affects the correction factor, we'll say vinyl chloride again, which if you recall originally had a correction factor of 3.96. And if we increase the fraction of waste in the landfill to 10% from 5%, the correction factor drops down to 2.57. which this makes sense logically, right? Because as we increase the fraction of waste in the landfill, that increases the concentration and decreases the amount that it will be diluted by the time it makes it to the receptor well. Finally, to indicate how this actually fits into the equations that we've talked about earlier, it's very simple. You just multiply the DAF by this correction factor. So using all of the default values, including the 5% waste in the landfill and vinyl chloride, we get a finite source correction factor of 3.96. We multiply the steady state nationwide DAF that Alex already mentioned is 20 to get a finite DAF of 79.2, which this means that if we have a finite source of vinyl chloride at a Superfund site, by the time it makes it to the drinking water well, it will be diluted by 79.2 times. So the resulting concentration will be 1 over 79.2 of the original concentration. And this equation at the bottom shows where this fits into the equations that we talked about earlier. And then before we move on to our future work in the next few slides, I just want to discuss some limitations to this finite source correction factor. The first of these is that the Rixey et al. Paper that we discussed is almost 25 years old at this point. So there's definitely a potential for this research to be either outdated or for there to be newer improvements. There's also the need to integrate regionalized default values if we move forward with the regional DAF values, because since there's so much overlap between the values used to calculate the DAF and then the values used to calculate the finite source correction factor, we need to make sure that we're consistent with that across the board. It's also really dependent on having accurate inputs. As you saw, small changes to that source decay constant can have really big changes for the finite source correction factor. So this is especially an issue, as I briefly discussed, with contaminants like PFAS that are emerging contaminants of concern that maybe don't have the same degree of research. And really, most importantly, this would be a change that would require a lot of intra and interagency discussion, because it would affect the availability to compare the soil to groundwater soil screening level with other MCLs, because currently across EPA and in other calculators such as the RPG, we're assuming an infinite source. So we're going to move on to Alex for a little bit to talk about our future work and then wrap up with some questions.
Great. Thank you, Seth. I think you should be able to see my presentation now. Okay, great. So future work, it's going to, like Seth said, it's going to be the next and last section, which is largely just reiterating some of the points we already made and suggesting next steps that could address some of the issues we did bring up. Okay, so to address the lack of data points in the hydrogeologic database, our project proposes leveraging hydrogeologic data from relevant Superfund sites, specifically those with soil to groundwater migration concerns, to expand the HGDB. On this map are the locations of most of the 1,500 Superfund sites that have published remedial investigation / feasibility studies. We got this data from the EPA website under the Superfund sites where you live map, where you can download the names, locations, and other information for every current, deleted, and posed Superfund site. Unfortunately for us, this information does not include hydrogeologic data, but that may be found within the remedial investigation / feasibility studies for each of the respective sites. These sites are color-coded for convenience by the hydrogeologic regions for our, and since we know the exact locations of each site, it should be possible to run a query using a PDF text reader of every remedial investigation / feasibility study to pull relevant hydrogeologic data that's already been collected during the site investigation or cleanup. So basically, we wouldn't be looking for anything that mentions the word words like dilution attenuation factor, hydraulic conductivity, infiltration rate, et cetera, that is mentioned in the this remedial investigation paperwork. And of course, using a PDF reader would be a lot quicker and easier than having individuals go through each remedial investigation looking for the relevant data. If you've never looked at one of these remedial investigations, they're often like hundreds, if not more than 1,000 pages long. So using a PDF reader is going to make this search a lot more practical. Any relevant data used to calculate a DEF can then be mapped to that hydrogeologic specific region, thereby expanding the hydrogeologic database. All right, so final couple of recommendations for future work. One possibility we did consider was simply replicating the original survey with more rigorous requirements for standardized techniques, data collection, quality control, survey experience, et cetera. Basically rebuilding the hydrogeologic database from the ground up. Of course, this is going to be a large and probably expensive project that may not be totally feasible. Alternatively, just for us to get an idea of the magnitude of potential error that's in the hydrogeologic database, a few randomized spot checks of survey sites could be conducted with, again, you know, more rigorous data collection and quality control methods.
Yeah. So we'll wrap up here before the conclusion with just a couple further assumptions and gaps beyond the scope of our project that need to be addressed. So the first and foremost of these is that currently the soil screening guidance assumes that no NAPLs are present at a site, which, as we know, is unfortunately not the case for many Superfund sites. So this would need to be a major area of research as we consider other changes to the soil screening guidance. Another big assumption is that there's no contaminant attenuation, including adsorption, biodegradation, or chemical degradation in the soil or aquifer. Well, this makes it a more conservative estimate, and potentially some of these things like biodegradation can be hard to calculate because it's potentially genus specific for the specific chemical. Some of these, like adsorption, could be fairly easy to calculate based on some of the kinetics values that we already use and our knowledge of things like soil mineralogy. And finally, a big emerging area of concern is PFAS, which, since they're so unique and they behave in unique ways, it would require a lot further research to address how they fit into the soil screening guidance, whether they can continue under organics or whether they'd need their own set of equations like NAPLs would. And so, in conclusion, one of the big standouts of this project was that the 1996 soil screening guidance still contains a lot of really valid information and valid models. Its main limitation was just when it was made. The computing power and the amount of data that was available to the original soil screening guidance authors is equivalent to what we have in our pockets, most of us these days. And now we're living in an era where we have almost too much data. So moving forward with other proposed changes to the soil screening guidance, in addition to ours, it's really our responsibility to leverage all of this data to improve the accuracy of the soil screening guidance while also maintaining its protectiveness for human health and environmental health.
All right, I believe we are moving into our, our Q&A session. And as we're getting ready to do that, I'm gonna move a few things around here on the screen, get both of our speakers spotlit. And I do want to pop up one final poll that the speakers have arranged for our audience as we get ready to launch into Q&A. So I'll just remind the audience, if you've already submitted questions or comments, we have those in the queue and we'll start reading through those in just a moment to be addressed, but you can keep sending in additional questions and comments as we go along. And then just as we jump into Q&A, I'm going to open up one last poll. And this last poll is simply asking if you're aware of any information on related studies or data sets that might be useful to this work. So that's a short answer style poll question. If you are aware of anything, have links or points of contact, feel free to share a response to that poll and submit it on in. If you don't, you can simply close that poll window and move it out of the way so you can focus on the Q&A. And we'll leave that open for the duration of our Q&A session here, giving you guys time to dig up any references or links that you might need. And gentlemen, I see 11 responses already. So this was, I think, a great question to pose to the audience. All right. So I'm going to start in with a question that came in early on a definition. Earlier on slide 6, you used an acronym MGW. Can you define that definition or that acronym?
Yeah, MGW just stands for migration to groundwater, which we were calling it the soil to groundwater pathway, but they're equivalent.
Okay. All right. And then a question on the DAF. If you have a large DAF value, does that indicate a larger concentration of contaminants?
I think you can correct me if I'm wrong, but no, that's been, the DAF is just referring to the amount of dilution that's going to happen from the leaching into groundwater.
Okay. And then the reference for a DAF of 20. So I have two different questions on that. One of the participants wanted to know, if the DAF is 20, is it more contaminated than if the DAF is 1?
So the resulting groundwater contamination, you're assuming more leaching if it's a DAF with a DAF of 1.
Okay. And then they wanted to, go ahead, Alex.
So the DAF does not really refer, it's independent of the actual concentration of contaminant at the site. It's more of a description of how the contaminant behaves in groundwater, and in particular with the physical environment of the groundwater at that site.
Okay. All right. And then that DAF value of 20, was that new or existing? One of the attendees noted that last March, EPA changed their thresholds for the concerning amount of contaminant dilution, and they wanted to know if this DAF reflects those changes. They're just curious how long a DAF of 20 has been in use.
We're tracking it's been in use since 1986, and it's the current guidance. I admit I'm not 100% familiar, so I'll see if Seth or Michael is.
Yeah, I'm not sure how long it was used before that, but I know that, you know, for example, in the regional screening level calculator, they also give you the option to use 1 for a more conservative value. So I think there are other options to use, and if you feel like the situation calls for a more conservative value.
Okay. All right. We have lots of questions on the DAF. I'm going to come back to that in just a moment there, because I want to take a quick diversion over to the map that we used. And somebody wanted to note, where is Alaska? I didn't see it on the map.
Yeah, that's one of the biggest issues with the map, actually, is that the original data was calculated for the contiguous US. They split it up into really nice regions, and then they decided that all of Alaska was one region, all of Hawaii was one region, and then all of Puerto Rico, Guam, Northern Marianas Islands, and so on were one region, which Alaska is a big state. So that's not the best choice, in my opinion. And that would be something moving forward that we would want to address.
Okay. And just a side note, we have several international guests, some from other countries, including Canada. Sad to say, Canada was not on the map either. And if you have recommendations for those that might not be in the US, what they could do?
So I think, including in the US, there's the need to form better maps of our hydrogeologic regions, which, as you saw, the values that went in to calculate the map that we used were all dependent on the hydrogeologic on aquifer values. But since we're looking at soil screening, there's a need to also integrate soil survey values, I believe, as well as these hydrogeologic values. So in terms of a workflow, if you were to build this up from scratch, I would try to take soil survey value, which in the US, we have an excellent resource through the USDA NRCS soil survey. I know Canada also has a really good soil survey. So taking some of those values, such as texture, such as organic carbon content, clay mineralogy, for instance, because that can affect adsorption. And then also collecting hydrogeologic data, and then integrating those using something, a classification method like random forest or another machine learning method to come up with regions that are appropriately large that you can come up with default values, but also not so large that they erase important differences.
Okay. All right. Excellent. Some people really love the map. They want to know where they can get it. Is it posted on the EPA's website?
We have very small versions available in our paper. And then I am also happy to email anyone the shape files for it. So reach out to me. My contact information's at the end.
Okay. Excellent. Could you clarify on a term that you used regarding fraction of waste in the landfill? They ask because they have a lot of sites that are not landfills and they aren't sure what to do.
Yeah. So sorry, that's my fault. That's the term used by Rixey et al. In their original paper. By landfill, I would just interpret that as the contaminated site.
Okay. Okay. All right. How about for your infinite source calculator? Do you have a chemical name that's equivalent to TPH or mineral oil?
I don't believe so off the top of my head.
Okay. All right. Has your approach looked at or included radionuclides?
Yeah, so that's also another important thing to point out. Our the finite source correction factor in particular only works for organics. So we didn't consider radionuclides, and then we also didn't consider inorganic contaminants like metals.
Okay, well, related to that, how does the finite source correction factor calculation change in soils where the fraction of organic carbon is below the critical FOC or fraction of organic carbon? And they say, for example, soils where mineralogical sorption dominates over the organic carbon-based sorption.
Mm-hmm. As I just alluded to, I think that this is a big oversight currently because it only includes the that carbon value where, like you mentioned, like where we if we have smectitic mineralogy with significant shrink swell, that could lead to a really high level of occlusion or fixation, depending on the contaminant, but that doesn't show up anywhere in the equation.
Okay. Can they assume that the infinite source that is built into the SSL already makes the SSL more conservative than when you're assuming a finite source? I'm seeing nodding heads from both of you.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay. It's a good assumption to make. Excellent. Thank you. All right. We did have one audience member who wanted to know if you've looked at any case studies to calibrate or test that finite source correction factor to evaluate its accuracy.
No, we have not yet.
All right. Well, I might encourage them if they know of a case study or site that they think would be great for that type of work to feel free to put that in the poll question as a related data set or study that might be useful. So if you have a case study or data set that could be used for calibration, go ahead and include that in the response to the poll. Okay, we do have a comment here about your DAF, and I'm going to go back to that. One of the attendees made a comment here that one main assumption not mentioned is that the DAF applies to a receptor within or at the edge of the area of concern. So that's your parameter L in the equation. And they just really think that's a significant limitation to discuss with the audience. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, so the soil screening guidance, the default value applies, I believe it says in a half acre area. And then anything over that, it says it, you know, may not be as accurate. So I think that's a good area to look into in the future too. And I think in the appendix that Alex mentioned, they do look at other or larger areas. That's something that might be that we could look into too.
Just to kind of expand on that question, on page 39 of the soil screening guidance, which is a guy that was trying to find stuff while we're doing this, it says, quote, under the exhibit 12, simplifying assumptions for the SSL migration for groundwater pathway. Again, page 39 of the document, It says receptor well at the down gradient edge of the source and screened within the plume. So.
All right, excellent. Let's move on to our next one. Are the DAF and finite factor applicable if regulations state that soil cannot impact groundwater above a groundwater remediation objective? They go on to say that this appears to set the receptor point as the well intake, not the groundwater itself. So any thoughts or answers for that one?
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a really valid point, and that's part of the assumption that the SSL was written using, because we're starting off with whatever we're assuming is the safe level, or the MCL or MCLG, or any of the other values that Alex mentioned, and then taking that, we're back calculating from the receptor well, so it's defined by default as coming from the well, which, as you pointed out, is potentially an issue because it doesn't apply to the groundwater as a whole.
Okay. All right. So again, that dilution factor, you're going to have an issue if you have a site where the underlying groundwater is already contaminated.
So again, this everything we kind of discussed is used before, well, not necessarily before groundwater contamination occurs, but when you are doing that initial, during the initial risk assessment process. Mm-hmm. So you may not know that the underlying groundwater is already contaminated. If you do, you can kind of see what's in the soil, what the soil concentration of that contaminant is, and then try to predict, you know, groundwater contamination is going to be, and then, you know, compare it to what you currently measured, assuming you have that measurement.
Okay.
So that is one way you can use it.
Okay. One of our participants, I believe he is coming in from Hawaii, asked if you were familiar with existing and what he states are more rigorous soil leaching models, such as SESS soil. I apologize if I'm mispronouncing the acronym. So SESOIL and VLEACH, VLEACH. He says that SESS soil in particular takes into account several of the issues that you've brought up, in particular loss of contaminants in the leachate due to volatilization and retardation of highly sorptive compounds.
So I do think some of these other models are mentioned in part of the soil screening guidance. And the only issue is that, like I mentioned at the beginning, the model that we have in the soil screening guidance it's meant to be used in the early stages of site evaluation where not much site-specific information is used. So that is kind of the purpose for a lot of these underlying default assumptions and values. And so maybe later on in the lifetime of a site, when you have more site-specific information, you could transition to one of these other models that are kind of meant to be used with more site-specific values.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. So I have a number of people who have asked this particular question. And so I'm going to try to find all of them and acknowledge them when I ask this one out loud. If the EPA default DAF value is 20 for half of an acre of a site, what DAF value should you use for a site that's more than a half acre?
Well, I think that really depends on the site. I don't believe the soil screening guidance has a default value for an area larger than that. A more site-specific value might be appropriate, or just if you wanted to be more conservative, I think the regional screening level calculator uses one. So like I said before, looking into larger areas is something that we could look into in the future too for more possible updates to the guidance.
And so just kind of expand on that, had to go back to this slide. You can see L right here, that's what you're referring to, the length of length of area of concern parallel to groundwater flow. One of the things I don't think I mentioned is one of the assumptions in the soil screening guidance is that the area of concern or the plume, whatever, is a square shape. And so if you have a bigger view, and then also this L is for a half acre source, which translates to 45 meters. And so if you have a larger area of your concern, you're gonna have obviously a larger L, which of course makes this value smaller, which makes, you know, this overall value smaller, which means there's gonna be more, it's a lower DAF, which means higher, lower amounts of dilution. Sorry, getting confused with that. So ultimately the EPA had a default value of half an acre, I guess, or not, I guess. I believe I read that it's basically the assumption of whatever the average or an average size, expected size of a contaminant source when you don't know exactly how big the source may be. So hopefully that answers your question. But obviously when you do know, you could obviously update the DAF that you use.
Okay. Could you touch on how that initial DAF was calculated? Were the data fields validated using some distance from the source and then in calculating a ratio using the field concentration? Trying to make sure I'm reading this one correctly.
So, and that's the initial DAF.
The initial DAF. Yep. 20.
So, the information we were able to get from that time is pretty limited, mm-hmm. and you know, I don't think we were able to find any specific discussion on the calculations, but. From what I've gathered, I think it was just an average of all of the DAF values from the hydrogeologic database, that like those four, that set of 400 data points that Alex mentioned before.
Okay. We've also had a few people ask, does the RSL calculator use a DAF of 1 or 20?
I think by default, it uses 1, but I do believe it, you have the option to use 20 also, but I'm not 100% sure on that, but I think that might be the case.
Okay. And this is another theme I'm trying to scroll through, because every time I think we get through one question, we get two more. So bear with me as I'm kind of circling through and trying to merge some of these common themes together. A number of people have commented on this idea of site-specific DAFs. And people love the presentation, and they just wondered if there is any thought on encouraging the calculation of site-specific DAFs rather than using default values. And a number of people have commented that this approach is used in some EPA regions where they recognize the limitations of EPA's DAF defaults, as well as some states. And again, I've got a number of people who have said some states will allow you to calculate site-specific DAFs.
Yeah, I think that's a really great question. And I think anywhere where you're able to obtain more site-specific information, it's mm-hmm. probably always better to use site-specific information when you have it. So I would encourage the use of that. And like I said before, this is just meant for the early stages where you don't have the information to use. So I think, yes, once you do have that information for your site, it would be good to incorporate that into your site model.
Okay. All right. I am going to go back up here to a question that came in. Can you talk about the relation of the leachate concentration to the contaminant concentration in soil where the contaminant is mostly measured?
So the relationship would... I guess, so when you're calculating the migration of groundwater pathway, you would first look for your kind of target concentration in groundwater, and then multiply that by the DAF to get an acceptable leachate concentration. And then from there, you would calculate an acceptable soil concentration that you would need to clean up to, that would kind of limit the leachate to a level that would allow or kind of restrict I guess, your groundwater concentration to be below a certain limit. I don't know if I described that. I don't know if Alex or Seth, if you could describe that any better.
Nope. Seth, anything?
Yeah, I mean, that was a really good description. And the way that I like to think of it too is just if we have the whole purpose of the soil screening guidance is to kind of streamline the cleanup process, because if we're going over after every single site that's contaminated with a certain contaminant, no matter the level, it will take forever, and we may be spending the same amount of effort on sites that have minute concentrations compared to the right underneath the leaky barrel, so to speak. So this helps us, as Michael just mentioned, it's this whole back calculation process. And then once we have that soil screening level, anything that is below that level, we can kind of tentatively cross off so that we can focus on the areas that have a concentration above.
Okay. Let's take a question about depth. It's noted that the depth to groundwater is not included in the DAF calculations. For sites where groundwater is 100 feet deep or more, can that DAF be adjusted?
I think, and Alex can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think there is a term for the depth to the top of the aquifer in the full equation way back at the beginning. I'm not sure if that's incorporated into the DAF specifically. Let's see. Yeah, interesting. Yeah, so I guess that's right then. And we did have some discussions about the difference between the aquifer thickness and aquifer mixing zone depth. So I can refer back to those. And if you shoot me or Alex or Michael an email too, we can try to get back to you on that.
Okay. And I'm getting down to the bottom, and we had a number of individuals who have chimed in with some clarification on earlier questions. So we just had one participant confirm that the RSL allows the user to input any DAF, but one is the default. So I just wanted to thank them for that. A number have chimed in from New Jersey that New Jersey's DEP has technical guidance that allows for calculations of site-specific DAFs. And they even have a calculator specifically for that purpose. So they suggested that members of the audience look that up. We also did have a commenter who said that if it's larger than 5 acre or half an acre, EPA guidance recommends a DAF of 1 unless a site-specific value is calculated. So again, another push for that site-specific data whenever you can get that in. And we had someone chime in and just note that the SESOIL acronym, which I may or may not be pronouncing correctly, SESOIL, stands for Seasonal Soil Compartment Model, and it is also in use by the New Jersey DEP. So I do want to thank everybody for chiming in with those thoughts and responses as well to some of our questions. We love community response to the questions that are coming in. Real quick question here coming in. They said it doesn't appear that soil to groundwater calculator accounts for different soil layers. So they wondered how heterogeneity impacts the DAF.
If it's not apparent already, I'm a soil scientist, so this is something that I constantly
very passionate about.
Yeah. But if you, I mean, looking at the actual math behind the DAF and then some of the diagrams in the soil screening guidance, it almost assumes a situation where like the contaminant is leaking directly into a pipe leading to the aquifer. There's really not, besides a couple values, there isn't that much consideration of the soil, even assuming the soil is one homogeneous body, like let alone a horizonation.
Okay. We did have a comment that came in that the depth to groundwater really wouldn't matter in an infinite source anyway. So I just wanted to circle back to that one that we were discussing earlier and acknowledge that comment that came in. Okay, let's see, as I'm scrolling through here, there are still a number of additional questions in. I want to try to get through as many as we can here. Let's go back up and just ask a question. Does a high DAF value, indicating a large reduction of contamination due to either sticking to soil media by adsorption or by filtration or by dilution, dispersion, or biological changes, they're asking, we're right, that that's what a high DAF value would mean. If that's correct, then there is a question about if the contaminants absorbed to the soil matrix could then be desorbed over time and thus mobilized. And then a second follow-on question, could those contaminants pivot to possible biological excretion or changes to chemicals to another chemical of concern? I don't know if you have any thoughts on those questions.
Oh, go ahead, Seth.
Yeah, despite the terminology of dilution attenuation factor, the DAF doesn't really deal with attenuation. It's solely based on dilution. So it doesn't include biodegradation or sorption.
Okay. All right. I am moving through here. What if you were in a desert area? Would low annual rainfall reduce the spread from soil to groundwater?
Yes, and that would tie into the infiltration rate value shown on here. It would also, in a desert area, depending on the kind of desert and the site, I would suspect that groundwater contamination may not be the most pertinent soil screening level compared to the, there's one about dust. That may be even more of a concern, especially if you're in an area with a lot of aeolian activity.
Okay. And just to confirm, DAF does not include attenuation. I can say it for the people in the back.
Yes, DAF does not include attenuation, especially attenuation via adsorption or degradation, either chemical or biological.
Okay. All right. I am going to go down to this next question. Getting back to the fraction of waste in a landfill, someone wanted to know, how do we interpret the input for that, quote, fraction of waste in landfill? Would this be the vertical fraction contaminated while the lateral fraction would go into the extent?
I need to check back on the original Rixey et al. Paper to see how they defined it.
Okay.
Which I would also be happy to share with you and anyone else who has this question if you email me. I will check back on it.
Okay. So one of our participants says that there are issues with the standard advection dispersion diffusion equation, and current thinking is that it should be the advection diffusion equation. In other words, there's no dispersion. Do you want to comment or speak on that?
I don't think I have any comments on that, but that's good to know. That's something we can look into also.
Okay. All right. We do have a comment that a soils database, unfortunately, does not have the hydraulic conductivity data, but they said a lot of times you can infer it from what you're seeing in there. And Seth, I don't know if you have any observations on how they might get hydraulic conductivity information.
Yeah, no, they're right that it would be... and that is potentially an area that we'd have issue with using databases, is we have a fairly good idea of the solem data. So everything down to bedrock, or what soil scientists would consider bedrock. And then we have fairly good data for aquifers, but we don't necessarily have that as many high quality data sets for the vadose zone. which is obviously really important for these calculations.
Okay, I am moving here to another question. Bear with me. Getting back to those data points in the 1996 geological screening, and I know the information from that time frame is limited. They just wondered if you knew how they collected the data. Did they drill into the ground? Did they scan the ground and create a model of substrates in the soils? Any information on how they got that data?
It was pretty varied. Seth, you might be able to explain more of the specific things, but some of them were just, it was really a wide variety, and something slug tests. I forget what the other ones are for hydraulic conductivity. Seth, I don't know if you could.
Yeah, that was, as Alex discussed, that was actually one of the major issues with that data set, is that they sent out a survey and then got all of the data back without verifying it themselves or without requiring some sort of standard methodology. So the answer is whatever the unnamed person who collected the data used, which isn't very helpful, but it's unfortunately the case.
Okay. And I do want to just chime in that there are a number of comments, recommendations, graphics, other tools that are coming into the Q&A, and I am seeing all of those, and I will be passing these all on to the presenter. So I just want to acknowledge people who are chiming in with some additional resources and suggestions. For right now, I'm going to try to focus on the question specific that we have, information we have in the Q&A, but keep sending that information in. Any recommendations or tips, or if you have a file you'd like to share, you can't upload it in Zoom, but you can always email me. I'll be happy to collect it and then pass it along to the presenters. All right, so getting back to our questions and the time that we have remaining, one of the attendees wanted to know, would you say it's accurate to say that the finite source correction factor is a way of adjusting the DAF to be chemical specific?
Yes, yeah. And in the original paper, they point out too that and if you play around with the calculator yourself, you'll see that many of the finite source correction factor values do come out to essentially between 1 and 1.5. So they're not a major change compared to the DAF. This is especially true for NAPLs, which are not included in the soil screening level, so they're not necessarily included in the correction factor calculator. But just because of the chemical properties of NAPLs, it's essentially the same thing as what it might look like with just a regular DAF.
Okay, excellent. All right. I apologize. This is the question. Can SPLP data with solute soil ratio specified by the method be used for the starting point to apply the DAF?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that question?
Sure. They ask, can SPLP data, and then in parentheses, with the solute soil ratio specified by the method, be used for the starting point to apply the DAF?
I'm personally not familiar with that data, so I'm not sure on that.
Okay. Okay. I'll ask them to clarify. Mm-hmm. And see if we can come back to this one. All right. We do have a number of individuals, again, circling back that state policies can vary widely from what is in EPA's guidance. And that includes that the receptor well location may be very different than what EPA's SSL is using. One participant even chimed in with an example of another variation from their state that Texas risk assessment guidance recommends a DAF equal to 10 for sites that are between half an acre to 30 acres in size, so that there can be a high degree of variability depending on where you're located.
Really quick, I just did want to mention regarding the receptor well location. I do remember, I believe New Jersey's guidance specifically stated that all groundwater needs to be protected. So then that mm-hmm. basically makes the receptor well location irrelevant.
Yes. Somebody had a question. They said it's not clear to me that that finite source correction factor is really adjusting an infinite source model to a depleting source model. They wanted to know, is it really more of a way of adjusting the DAF to be chemical specific?
Yeah, and it's based on graphically, the way that it ends up working out is, if we imagine the level of contamination in a soil over time, in groundwater over time, it'll increase and it'll peak at a certain point, and then it'll decrease as it is dispersed more and more. So the value in the finite source correction factor is based on the concentration at the peak time, which it makes it a little bit more protective, because even though we're moving from an infinite source to a finite source, it's still the maximum concentration.
Okay. We have a question that the SSL equations 1 and 2 for inorganic and organic respectively appear to be the same, with KD equal to KOC times FOC. Can you speak to the major difference between the two equations?
I think that the main difference is just the kind of contaminant that it's okay. Because for organic compounds, KD is KOC times FOC.
Okay. We have another question. How do you think that the experience in studying and developing DAF for leaching to groundwater could inform the calculation of attenuation factors for migration of vapors upwards through the soil?
Oh gosh, that's a good question. I really am not sure. That's something we definitely haven't looked into. But you know, maybe that's always something we could look into in the future.
Okay. All right. We did have a clarification that came in that SPLP data is used towards calculating the SSL for the soil to groundwater pathway. And again, New Jersey DEP has a good calculator and guidance on it. One of our attendees noted Region 2 used that approach as well. So they just wanted to clarify that was probably what the questioner was asking about, that SLP data or SPLP data. Okay, I'm going to go back here to a question that came early on. This one wants to know if you've looked at contaminated groundwater due to CAFO, C-A-F-O pollution from manure wastewater storage leakage and from land application of liquid manure wastewater. They were just curious if you might be talking or looking at waste liner failures as part of some of your work.
Short answer, no. Basically, this was just for generic guidance.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. And I'm going to wrap it up here because I know we are running short on time. And I do want to make sure we acknowledge and respect everybody's time here. If you haven't set in a response to that poll question about potential data sets or studies, please go ahead and do so. I'll be closing that here in just a moment. But we did have a few questions about input and how EPA is working with the professional community. Earlier on, one of the attendees said that there's not currently a, quote, association of groundwater scientists and engineers. And they wondered if there are other professional groups that EPA is working on and assembling input from professionals in working in these situations. And other people have put in similar comments sort of throughout the Q&A break here, asking how EPA will be getting input on this work from the scientific community in the future.
Yeah, so really throughout this project, we've been scouring everywhere we could find for information, whether it be in databases or through contacts. And we haven't been able to find that much. So I really appreciate everyone who's, you know, sending in, the information that they have. And I think like Alex mentioned before, we've also been looking at our own databases, past site investigation reports where we might've calculated our own DAFs for sites, or where we at least have information like hydraulic conductivity and infiltration and information like that, where we could back calculate a DAF. That in and of itself is, we found, a lot of work, so could probably be a whole separate intern project in the future, just because obtaining those documents is a lot, and then going through them. Some of them are very old, so even just using a program to scan them is difficult. So we're definitely looking for all of that information. And if anyone has any, feel free to send it in and get in contact with us, because we'd love to see that.
All right, excellent. Well, I think just in the interest of time, we'll go ahead and close this out, because you all have been going through questions for 40 minutes. And I know there's a lot of information that has come in, many recommendations and links and suggestions. So I do want to thank you both for sharing your project. And Michael, I want to thank you for introducing us and helping to tee up these questions for the group. So if you'd like to put that last slide up again with your contact information, I'll just remind everyone, the presentation materials can be downloaded. I'm going to go through final reminders here in a moment, but I will turn it back to you three gentlemen to do a final call. If someone has an outstanding question, or they have an idea, or they have a data set, what should they do?
Yes, please. If anyone has any further information, if anyone has any questions, if they'd like any of the material that we've presented today, feel free to contact any of us below. And I appreciate everyone joining today. And thank you, Jean.
All right. Excellent. Thank you so much. I'm going to go ahead and swap out the view here in just one moment and walk through some final reminders before we go ahead and conclude today's live broadcast. So I want to echo your thanks. And I just, again, want to thank the three of you for joining us, as well as the nearly 400 participants who joined us live for today's session. I'll encourage you to stay connected with us at the Cleanup Information Network or CLUIN websites. And please, if you're not subscribing already, you should sign up for Tech Direct, our free monthly newsletter, which I send out on the first of each month, which has information about resources, webinars, events like today's session that we offer out to all environmental cleanup professionals. Now, if you were not here at the beginning, I'll just remind everybody, copies of the presentation materials, links to the calculator, links to their paper, links to other related resources, all of that is available here on the seminar homepage. It's the URL shown in red. That seminar homepage is the same place you went when registering. It's the same place we sent you to in your reminder emails. It's where you went to check in, and it's where I'm going to send you now that the session is over. So again, just scroll up and down to the appropriate sections on that page, and you'll be able to access the materials, as well as our online feedback form, because that will be one of the last requests that I have, that you fill out that online feedback form, which is available here. If you scroll, it's about midway through the options. Now, many times I get asked if we offer PDHs or CEUs, and while we do not offer those types of credit hours, I can provide each of you with a participation certificate. As soon as you fill out the seminar feedback form, which is on the seminar homepage. Once you submit that feedback form, if you make sure you check a box at the bottom of the form to certify you were here for the whole delivery, once you submit it, you'll immediately have access to a certificate that you can download or print out for your own records. If you happen to have multiple parties join at your location, each person can fill out that form on their own and get their own participation certificate, even if they didn't register. So if you were the one who led the viewing party, please be sure to send everyone who joined you to the seminar homepage so they can share their thoughts with us and get their own certificate. And final reminder, the session was recorded. You'll automatically get an email from me in about 1 to 2 weeks when that archive is available. And when you get that email, feel free to forward it on to other colleagues who will find it to be a valuable expenditure of their time. And if you happen to be one of the lucky people watching the recorded version right now, just about at this point in the archive, there will be a button above my head, which will point to the seminar feedback form. So you can still fill out that feedback form based on your replay of the archive and get a participation certificate. So if you'd watched today's session and want to share your thoughts with us, go ahead and do so, making sure you check the box at the bottom of the form, certifying you watched the whole thing, and then you'll get a participation certificate that you can download for your own records. So again, a great big thank you to all of my presenters, as well as our support staff who helped organize and those who were helping to run things in the background. And a big thank you to each and every one of you who joined us for today's live session. Really was a pleasure to work on this one. You were a great audience, and I hope I will see you on a future internet seminar. With that, we'll go ahead and formally conclude today's live broadcast.